This episode discusses themes of child sexual assault. Please seek the resources in the show notes if you are affected by these themes.
I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we're recording on today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. Sovereignty has never been ceded. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Yeah, I wouldn't wish that on anyone. It was really tough. And as hard as it was, I'm glad that we went through it. I kind of feel like for my brother and I, we kind of slated a dragon. It was a tough one for us.
Mark Wales is a former Special Operations Commander, fashion entrepreneur, two-time author, and you may recognise him from two seasons of Australian Survivor. He knows all too well the intensity of high-stress situations where personal and team performance can determine a life or death outcome. But his journey goes far beyond the battlefield. Today we discuss his upbringing in Western Australia, what it was like on the ground in Afghanistan, and we also touch on his journey and resilience in bringing a child sexual assault offender to light. We chat about earning an MBA from the Wharton School of Business, living in New York, and meeting his wife on national television. Thank you so much, Mark, for sharing your story. This is Life Chats, deep and meaningful conversations with friends and strangers. Okay, thank you for being here. You have had an incredible career. Just for the listeners, I want to read out a couple of the things. I'm sure there's many I'm missing off this list that you've managed to do in your lifetime so far. You've lived in America. You were an SAS troop commander. You served in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, East Timor, and the Solomon Islands. I also read, and we've spoken about you launching a fashion label. You have an MBA. You were on Survivor twice. You've written a book, and I'm sure there's more there, but you've obviously lived a very big life. I'm really interested in uncovering, do you think that that is intrinsic to who you are as a person? You've always strived for big experiences, or did young Mark kind of had no idea what he was in for?
I grew up in a pretty basic part of WA. We didn't really have, it wasn't a global city. Mm-hmm. There were no kind of aspirations there. Not many people from our school went to uni or college. So the one thing I did have was always interested in movies and science fiction stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was drawn to the images of soldiering as a kid. I remember seeing photographs of the SAS in action. Mm-hmm. And just thinking that looked like such an amazing career. Yeah, and that's what pulled me towards the army. And I think it was an important point because when I went through a training in the military and then going to SAS, it taught me that just showing up to something and trying really hard, even when the odds are low, there's a good chance you can fail, but if you don't try, you might really regret that later when you're not in a position to be able to do it. So I think it just taught me a really important early lesson that just try those things that you want to do and you won't get all of them, but even if you get a few, that's a good result.
Are there still a few big things on the list that you want to try in your lifetime? And if so, what are they?
I think there are. I've always wanted to do a bit of writing. I've got a fiction book coming out. I think I had a long discussion with this with my editor because I had the idea of doing another nonfiction book and I just wasn't that inspired. I'm like, I've got this other idea for a fiction book and I really want to work on it. And so I started that with him, but it was a much longer process than I thought. So it's taken a long time, but it's been fun and rewarding.
That's exciting. That's coming out next year, I believe.
Yeah, next June.
Exciting. Talk to me. You just mentioned you had a pretty basic upbringing. You grew up, is it Newman in the Pilbara region?
Yeah, Newman. I was born up there. That's right up north in WA. A lot of people in West Australia go to the mines.
So, yeah, is that what your parents did? Is that why you were there?
Yeah, they were. Dad was drove the haul pack trucks. And mum was stay-at-home mum most of the time, but she took care of three boys.
This is a question I ask almost every guest because I think it paints a picture for like the start or the early formative experiences in your life. When you just think of your childhood on a top level, what is like the first emotion that comes up?
Adventure. I was lucky. I was really lucky because I had brothers. We had a big open town in Perth and Geraldton where I lived. And we'd just disappear at sun up and we'd be gone until sundown. Our parents didn't know where we were most of the time. But that's how we lived back then. Mm. We had our bikes and off we went, and it was great.
Is that sort of like upbringing connected to land and with community and small towns? Is that something that you, because you have a son, is that something that you want for him, or it's just, it's a different world now and we maybe can't recreate that sort of lifestyle that was doable back then?
No, I think it's totally possible. And it depends on the environment. I've seen a lot of kids that grow up in inner city areas and they're kind of robbed of that experience of nature. They get exposed to a lot of other things, but for me, just having kind of free range kids is a good thing. And my parents kind of did it accidentally. They couldn't always look after us. So, but it was just fun for us. We loved it.
That was even like, I'm obviously probably just a generation under you, but like I was the same. I was told to just get outside, ride my bike, no electronics, be back when the streetlights came on basically. And we lived in a cul-de-sac. So it was just the kids in the cul-de-sac would go and like, I remember crushing up flowers and trying to make perfume and like doing all these little things to be creative because I really had no choice but to like invent those environments for myself. And I think that's formative. Like that changes your life when you have that upbringing.
Yeah. And you'll make mistakes too when you're unsupervised. And and that's like,
I smashed a window.
It's a key part of being a kid and learning those lessons. I think when kids get shielded too much, it doesn't help them.
So tell me, at what point, you said you were interested in the army or the SAS, at what point does that become a very real possibility? What age?
I was in grade 9. I think I was 13. Mm. I was young. And I remember seeing some photos on it and I went and researched it in the library. And just bit by bit, I realised that a military career was possible. Mm-hmm. Australia had an army. We had a Defence Force Academy where you'd go and get an undergrad degree and become an officer. And, and that was a path into the SAS. And so I remember talking to a friend about it. He wanted to apply to the same college. Mm-hmm. It, to me, it was just the most exciting thing to have two kids in Perth kind of dreaming of something that if we did, it would be a total coup. And we pulled it off and left year 12 and went there.
What were your parents' thoughts about that at the time?
They were puzzled initially. They were like, you know, the lower ranks of the army, and this comes from popular culture, people, you know, they're kind of, you know, they're, excuse my language, they're kind of shit kickers, right?
Yeah.
Like you go in and you do the hard work, you get told what to do. Mm. The more I researched it, the more I knew it was different to that. Mm-hmm. I knew there's an element of in soldiering where you're being trained and you have to conform. But once you're fully trained, you're actually left to your devices quite a bit. They'll give you a job and it's totally up to you how you do it.
Mm-hmm. So you said that, the lower ranks are more realistic to what it's like, but you actually made it up to the higher ranks. So what is that process like? I know you speak a lot about this in your book and you speak about it extensively elsewhere on podcasts and whatnot, but is that something that when you got into the army, you were like, I want the top rank, like I want to get to the SAS and I want to have that experience, or that just kind of naturally came about with your skills and your experience?
It was more of a protection mechanism. I was like, if I go through this and it doesn't work out, at least I come away with an undergraduate degree and some leadership experience, and that'll be something I can build on.
Totally.
It's kind of a fallacy that they're pushed around and told what to do as well. They, once they're fully trained, they're fully responsible for, you know, they might be tank drivers or whatever. So there's a lot of responsibilities you get given as a young person, which you just wouldn't find in everyday life. That was appealing to me.
What did you enjoy about just being in the army in general? What are some of the things that you think back on and think that was pretty cool that I got to do that?
Just the spectacle of it, of machinery and people just moving towards one kind of goal. And to me, it was like I think it was growing up watching films and thinking, God, imagine what that would be like for real.
Is that really what it is like when you're there and you're in Afghanistan and it's what you've been seeing on films?
It's funny because I thought the films would be an exaggeration of what happens for real, but it's actually the other way around.
Wow.
It's like a spectacle of fighting or war is actually much greater and bigger than they can ever depict on screen, and it has more impact for sure.
Did you feel like there was a great sense of camaraderie as well? I imagine like you've grown up in a small town and then you're part of this like bigger mission that's full of people probably just like you who were ambitious and driven.
Yeah, the good thing about it is the army breaks you down and rebuilds you with a set of values that's congruent to the military. And so you know how any person in the army is going to behave at any one point in time generally because we've got the same values, you know, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. You support your mates, you don't leave anyone behind. Like all those little things that don't sound like a big deal when everyone's grown up with the same values, it makes for a really good organization.
What were some of the parts that you didn't enjoy, like in the moment? I'm sure that it's different looking back on it now. You might feel differently, but were there any particular like tasks or just elements of it that you remember hating or really struggling with to adjust to?
I was impatient. It's such a big organization that it takes so many years to get to the good stuff. Like I was training for so long and I just wanted to go into the real hard training and do the combat missions and deployments. And you have to be patient. It takes a long time to kind of get there. And I had itchy feet.
What was the process like? Like how long were we talking to get into the SAS as well? And then once you're there, I guess, did it live up to what you thought it would be?
Yeah, the process was about 11 years for me from when I first heard about the SAS to when I actually walked on the selection course. It was a long time. And it kind of took that long. I had to mature as well. Like you have to be, your brain isn't fully formed. Your risk centers aren't fully formed until you're in your mid-20s and it's a little bit slower for men than it is for women.
And, that's a fact.
It's a fact, everyone. And so getting there, I think I was 24 when I did it. You've got to be a little bit older, I think, to be a good soldier. Yeah.
What would, and again, you talk about this in your book, but what are some of the things, I'm aware that you can't really speak to the details, but what are some of the things that go on in the SAS or the way that it runs that would surprise people? Or I guess, yeah, just what shocked you? Like, was there anything that you were like, oh, I didn't realize like this is what we'd be doing, or you're pretty well primed at that point when you make selection?
There's a lot of things that are in the public domain that everyone sees. So all the combat missions in Afghanistan, you know, hostage rescue, all those things that are kind of declared and seen in the public. There's a whole other side to the unit that is highly protected. And the reason it's protected is because it centers around intelligence collection against our adversaries. And it's something that the unit is very good at. We partner with a lot of different agencies to do it. And it's a highly protected capability as it should be. And that part is almost never revealed to the public. And I think for good reason. So I think people would be surprised to
The extent of that.
To see the extent of it. And I've been out for a long time, so I don't speak for them now. But when I was there, I was surprised by it.
Did you have any experiences that kind of stuck with you? I know people that work in the industry that you did, or first responders, or anyone who is kind of confronted with life and death on a daily basis, and then they leave and they might have a family or children, and that's kind of all put into perspective, the value of life, I guess. Have you ever had any issues with PTSD or I guess like just situations that seem to haunt you a bit or stick with you?
Yeah, for sure. I thought I was prepared for all this because I was a history undergrad. I'd done military history. I kind of read up all you'd read on combat, but there's no substitute for, I guess, practical exposure. And I remember some of the battles we got in one of the first tours I did as a troop commander. And I documented this pretty heavily in the book, but I talk about a particular battle we got into in the early stages of that deployment where we're in the Chura Valley, we're helping clear it of about 80 Taliban. And on the first morning of the battle, we got basically trapped against a cornfield, kind of on a river system. And we were stuck there basically for about 12 hours trying to get out. And it was a really intense situation.
Did you think you were going to die?
I didn't. There were a couple of moments where I was like, "Oh, this could be, this could get really bad really quickly." And there was so much kind of gunfire around and I knew there were people just in front of us that were being killed. They were getting hit by the helicopter, the Apache gunships. They were doing kind of gun runs. They were firing their cannons along this tree line and firing these huge missiles. And I knew they were hitting people. So it was just had this weird feeling that kind of life and death were overlapping in this really tight space. And it was super weird. It was like, I don't think I've ever felt more alive in that period, like probably 30 minutes only. And to get through it, I kind of thought, I can see how people get drawn to that, even though it scared me a lot. And I don't think I was necessarily drawn to it. I can see how people do.
Do you think that soldiers are cognizant of the value of life throughout their work? Is it something that, I guess it's different for every individual, but in your experience, is it something that's brought into like hyper focus because of what you're doing? Or is it something that is maybe compartmentalized and you don't really think or overthink life and death because you don't have the time or energy to? You're very focused on what you're doing. I guess that interests me.
Yeah, there's a bit of both. I think you have to be able to compartment off certain things that you'll see, or human suffering, or anything you'll see on a battlefield that's almost too much to absorb. If you took it all on board, you just have a breakdown. So I think soldiers can be very good and learn how to throw walls up to stop.
Is that something you're taught?
You're not taught it, no. Mm. But they did some research on this with special forces operators being exposed to imagery that was really confronting. They did brain scans on them and blood tests. And they figured out there was when they were told they were about to be shown a confronting image, they released a peptide that blocked some of the impact of the imagery in their brain. So that really shocked me when I heard that. Yeah. There was actually a mechanism for people to protect themselves.
And if you're doing that for decades, then that becomes a trained behavior.
Exactly.
For sure. What was the experience like leaving? Like, just briefly, because I know that, again, you do talk about this, but yeah, can you just, for anyone who's listening and who might not be familiar with your story, like, what mentally goes through your mind to leave SAS?
It's a difficult decision because you're giving up something that's been so hard to obtain, and you're also, we're also revered in the military. We have the benefits of being at the top of our profession. And so to give that away is hard, because you're going to go back to the bottom of some other industry or profession, and you're going to have to learn again. And that's the bit that I found difficult. And not only that, you're giving up your sense of purpose and the cohort that goes with it. So you really, you do walk out of an institution on your own.
Yeah, I guess, what was that process like for you? Just, again, we've spoken about this, but redefining your identity, like, what does that look like for someone who's particularly in a similar situation, or doesn't even know what they want to do, leaving one career, going into another? You've obviously got an MBA and you've done other things as well. Fashion, where do all those things intersect?
Yeah, for me, the big thing I did, I knew I wouldn't have a clear understanding of what I wanted to do when I left, but doing some full-time study and retraining myself would at least buy me that bit of time to figure it out, because there's a lot you don't know about the world when you leave the military, and I was in that position. So I spent 2 years doing a full-time MBA, and that exposed me to a lot of different industries. And I just spent time trying to concentrate on what was exciting to me, because that's where I think you're going to do your best work.
What do you mean you don't know much about the world when you leave? Why is that?
Well, I joined the Army when I was 17. I'd never been exposed to people that live kind of regular day-to-day lives, that go to a 9-to-5, that have the concerns that you might have in everyday life, and the different jobs and social circles they have. We're not exposed to that in the military. We hang around the same folks, and it's actually not that diverse in terms of how people think and act. It can be a good thing, because you need a force to do a certain job, but also it doesn't equip you well for when you leave.
What were some of the biggest struggles, other than just personal self-discovery? Was there any sort of assimilation back into regular life that you struggled with?
I was so exhausted by the time I left that when I went to business school, I kind of just, I didn't work anywhere near as hard as I should have.
And an MBA is like notorious for being quite difficult. Like, it's mentally taxing. It's obviously a huge workload. When you do it full time, there's a lot of networking involved, or like a lot of, you have to have a lot, you have to speak to your peers all the time. Like, it's not something you can just cruise through.
No.
Kind of do your assignments the night before.
No. And the school I went to is renowned for being one of the most quantitative, like, numbers focused.
Ivy League.
And it's Wharton School of Business. It's heavy finance kind of feeding school, but yeah, it's renowned for that level of rigor. And I didn't have that in my background. I was an arts major, and I had to really work that side of my brain and build that kind of muscle.
Hi everyone. A quick reminder that if you are loving this chat, I would be so grateful if you could take 2 minutes now to jump on whatever platform you're listening to this and leave a review, or share the episode you're currently listening to on social media. I'd love to see where you're listening from, if you're going for a walk, if you're at the gym on the treadmill, if you're driving. Obviously, don't take a photo if you're driving. But it is so incredible to see that we now have listeners from over 35 countries tuning in. And the more that we grow, the bigger guests I can bring you. I am so, so grateful that you're here on this journey with me. And I'm excited about the life chats that we have coming up with some absolutely inspiring guests. Thank you so much. In the best way, I am too. And I think a lot of people are, contradictory person. Like, you have one side of your life that's very clear cut and you're driven and you're ambitious and you've had that army career, but then you're creative as well. How do you balance the both? And do you ever feel like you had to sacrifice one for the other. What does that look like for you?
I think that's where the magic can really happen, is if you take yourself from one pool of expertise and try and build another one, mm-hmm. because where you can bring both of those to bear on each other can create really interesting mm-hmm. things. At the most extreme end of it, you look at someone like Elon Musk, who's really good with material science, building cars, for example, yep. with Tesla. Mm-hmm. Everything that he uses in that, he develops into his other industries and other businesses. And I think if you can find a way to do that as well, mine was kind of planning, operational expertise and, you know, discipline. And now I use that and apply it with creative endeavors.
Totally. Can we talk about a pretty large part of your story, which was more recent, opening up about child sexual abuse? Is that okay to talk about today?
Of course, yep.
So how did you decide, I guess, to come forward with that information? Because you've had such a big career. At this point, you're kind of like well-known in your industry, obviously, and I guess on social media and whatnot. Like what was the decision-making process like at that time? It was something that people can read up on. You did with your brother. You both came forward about the same person. I guess if you could give us an insight into what that was like for you.
Yeah, this was a really hard one. So to give people the background to it, my brother and I grew up in Perth in the 80s. My mum's side of the family were farmers. They had farms down in the southwest of WA. They grew cattle, milk, you know, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And when we were down there, there was a distant cousin of my mother's they had a farm nearby, and it was a dairy farm. And we'd always go down south and visit our grandparents. And part of that was we'd go around to these other farms. And mm-hmm. as kids, it was mm-hmm. great. You go out and do whatever you want, harass mm-hmm. cows and do whatever you want. And one of my cousins, I think he was like a third cousin, he would take us out as kids and he'd take us on the bike and do various things. Anyway, one of those days he sexually assaulted my brother and I. Mm-hmm. And I never forgot it. It was just a really confronting experience. And I remember talking to my brother about it later. We never told our parents, but I did once I was in high school, I think. I remember it was on my mind and I told him. Mm. And my parents confronted him, but we didn't press charges at that point. But years later, I kind of totally forgot about it. Mm-hmm. I just moved on with my life. Years later, Harry was born, my son. And by the time he was about 3 or 4 years old, I remember just thinking, like, how could someone do that? And it was on my mind. I went back to my brother. I'm like, hey, do you want to take this to the police and see if we can press charges? Mm-hmm. And to my brother's credit, he goes, yeah, let's go. And so we went. It was a really hard thing to do, actually. I was in a cold sweat. We booked an appointment down at the Northbridge Police Station and we went and saw an investigator and we gave a statement and she was really good about it. And she said, you know, this stuff happens all the time and people get away with it. And she goes, I can't tell you about this case and how much weight it has, but let's pursue it. And it took 2 years during COVID for them to go and collect all the evidence.
Wow.
And eventually arrested him.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to trial at the back end of the COVID pandemic in Western Australia. And my brother and I had to go on.
It's a lot to go through.
I knew it was going to be hard, but it shocked me just how much that brought up.
Reliving the memory as
yes.
well.
Yeah. Yeah. And not only that, but It was hard on the whole family.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard on my brother too. Yeah, I wouldn't wish that on anyone. It was really tough. And as hard as it was, I'm glad that we went through it because he was found guilty by a jury. And I kind of feel like for my brother and I, we kind of slated a dragon. It was a tough one for us as kids. We were that small, and I'm glad we kind of went full circle and came back from. Yeah, it's a really tough one. It affected me quite a lot, more than I probably realized. Yeah, it was hard.
Thank you for sharing. And there will be people listening to this, and we'll obviously do trigger warnings and whatnot at the start. But there'll be people listening who have the same experiences and perhaps haven't ever told anyone. And I imagine this will be incredibly you know, hopeful to them to know that this can be done. Like, it doesn't matter how many years later, if you decide that you need that and you want to go through that process, it can be done.
Yeah, we did an article with an ABC journalist for exactly that reason, because there would be a lot of people in the same situation that never pursue it for some reason, because it's just too much difficulty going back, you know, raking over those coals and revisiting something that was a trauma for a young person. But what I can say to those people is we were treated really well by the police. The justice system really impressed me. They basically just, you present your case and a jury of your peers decides whether they believe you or not. And we had pretty good evidence, but, you know, overall it was super tough, but I'm glad we did it.
Can I ask, what was the initial response when you told your parents as a teenager? Like, why was that kind of, that person was confronted and it was just kind of dismissed? Or I imagine for you, that would have been quite hard, having the courage to actually have the conversation and then nothing really comes of it.
Yeah, I think my parents believed us and took action.
Mm-hmm.
We're in the middle of exams and we kind of were unsure about whether to pursue it, and we chose not to. And that's, I still think that was okay, because we went back to it later. We found out later that there are a lot of other victims. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of other victims out there. And so that's another thing I'd say to people that have had this happen to you, that if you do come forward, it's not just for you. You could be helping a whole lot of other people and even preventing other things from happening in the future.
Honestly, like, I take my hat off to you, because I look at the career you've had. I think people outwardly assume, you know, you've written that this was harder than going to the Middle East, like this process.
Yeah.
And people, I think, assume that if you're a strong, tough man, that these experiences are doable, but they can be completely like soul shattering, and they can call into question like who you are as a person and your relationships and everything. So
yeah.
I really respect and admire that you went through that process, not just for you, but for everyone else and for your son, who you mentioned at the start. Like, knowing his dad was strong enough and courageous enough to do that is huge.
Yeah. And I think in life in general, some of those things that we just want to avoid so badly is actually the areas we need to wade into at some point. And it's hard, because it's just, I could think of anything I'd rather do than go back and revisit this stuff, but it is important to finding perspective and moving on.
Yeah, I appreciate you talking about it even today. I think what I'd like to just draw from it is, I read a little bit online, your brother is like into bodybuilding, or he's had a career doing that, and you obviously had a very physical career and still do. Do you think those were, in response at all to what you went through, a mechanism of perhaps safety or like self-agency to have these very physical careers?
I think so. I think it was subconsciously, it was a part of it for sure. Just that the ability to look after yourself, to have that independence that if something happens, you can either protect yourself or other people. I think that was you just don't want to repeat that situation again. I think that was a big part of it.
Something that we didn't talk about, and I imagine would be quite challenging for people who are in the army, is relationships. Like, did you have a romantic relationship as a teen or in the army, or that's just not possible with the work that you do?
I did. I had girlfriends, and I remember saying, though, the work we're doing in the army is so hard that if you have a family at that point, you're just not going to see them either. So I did have girlfriends, but I was pretty kind of non-committal to be engaged or married, just because I knew it would be so hard to keep it together.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to your incredible partner now, who you met on Survivor.
Yeah.
You've been on Survivor twice. You obviously have beautiful Harry together. Tell me, what are your memories of just the decision to join and be cast in Survivor the first time around?
It was such a bizarre thing to do when I look back at it, but it was so much fun. So I was in New York at the time working in a consulting firm, and it was the depths of winter. Was snowing. It was just a New York winter. It can be hard if anyone's
depressing.
Been through it. You don't get direct sunlight for about two or 3 months. And by the end of winter, everyone's crying into their ears. it's a real thing. Anyway, I remember visiting a friend who was from business school, and he was a Texan, and he was telling me about a friend that had been on Survivor in America and how much fun it was. He was on a tropical island. It was beautiful. And I was like, oh, I'd love to do that.
I could do with a holiday.
I could do that. And I'd always had an interest in kind of film and TV.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard Australia was casting a show, so I applied for it and got a call back the next day and spoke to him on Skype and then ended up auditioning back in Australia.
And what was the experience like for you, like first time round? Is it what you thought it would be?
Yeah, it was unreal because I had no experience with TV and it's in Special Forces, you're trying to do the opposite of that. You're trying to stay away from any kind of exposure. So when I went on to Survivor, I remember day one on the set when they walk us out to the mats, there was a couple of hundred people, like crew and helpers on the side. And I was like, whoa.
People don't realise what goes into it because I am External 10. I never was on set, but I used to do all the sponsorships of these big shows. So like Tylenol would sponsor Survivor and they'd get like a little pop-up tent and you guys would get like a reward and all go in. That was what I was doing. But people just underestimate these swarms of teams that work behind the scenes, both in production and on set, just to bring it to life. Like where does the KFC come from when you're on a tiny island, you know, all these things.
Yeah, and what I loved about it is that it felt like the same thing as the military. There's a big group of people trying to do something, but this was, it's all about entertainment and having fun ultimately. And it was such a different approach to, I guess, my life in the military. It was just something kind of not as serious and just good fun.
Where were you at that point in your life? Were you kind of just like, yes to the experience? Did you want to go back to New York and continue consulting? Like something like going on a reality show can really throw a spanner in the works. And clearly with your life, it completely changed the trajectory with meeting your wife. But where were you at in that first season? Did you think it was just going to be this fun little few months and then back to normal life?
I think I wasn't happy in consulting because I knew it wasn't what I wanted to do with my life. And I think you just, everyone's had it where you're going to something every day and you're like, this isn't right. Can't quite figure out why or I can't figure out what to do next. And so I was having that thought every day, like what do I actually want to do that's going to be different and fun and still earn an income?
And let's talk about meeting Sam. Like you're on a reality show. That in and of itself is like you're trying to actually survive and make it through and get through the physical challenges and you don't have food and it's uncomfortable where you're sleeping, et cetera, et cetera. And then you also fall in love, which is a whole other experience even on the outside world. That's like a big thing to go through. So I guess just any reflections on that. And do you guys talk about it and laugh and kind of, yeah.
Yeah, it was hilarious because it's such a, it's a good first date being on, you know, Survivor and in a jungle for, you know, a few weeks and freezing and starving and whatnot. But I remember Sammy was a real live wire. Like she wouldn't sit still. She was always up doing something. She had an infectious laugh and she had the same values as me. Like we kind of clicked straight away when we were on the show. And because we were inexperienced about kind of Survivor, we made the big mistake, which is never form a power couple and, you know, get too tight. So we got targeted early in that one, but it worked out well. We went home and formed a great relationship and had little Harry. But so it was a huge win. And then to go back a second time, I think it was 3-4 years later, that was a huge, I never really expected to go back a second time, but we jumped at the chance and it worked out well.
How was that having a young baby or a child at that time? Because I've just got like a note you wrote something online. Playing is a dream for so many people and we didn't want to disappoint. We left our son Harry behind. This filled me with determination because we were giving up time with him and time with him means so much to me after the experiences I have lived. Is that something that's like in the forefront of your mind every day you're out there?
Yeah, it was really hard. I remember I got to about, I think it was about a week in, and I said to Sam, I'm not sure if I can do the whole thing. Yeah, because I felt like there was a chance we were going to be there for the whole stint.
Yeah.
And Sam was good about it. She's like, no, we're here. Like, let's get it done. But it made me way more ruthless because I'm like, if we're out here and I'm missing out time with my son, we're going to, like, do whatever it takes. And one of the guys I paired up with, Josh, he's since had a kid as well, and he goes, oh, mate, I get what you were saying now when you had to leave your boy behind, it made you play differently.
Totally. And it's always the most emotional, I think, part of the season. It's like when you do the family reunions and also when you get like a call from home or you get a video message or something because you realize what people are sacrificing to be there. So is he old enough to understand or do you talk about or does he watch reruns and see you on TV or any of that?
Yeah, he understood because at the time he couldn't articulate himself properly because he was only kind of 3 years old. But now we talk to him about it. Like, do you remember when mum and dad went away? And he's like, oh, yeah, I remember.
I remember.
He didn't think we were coming back.
Oh, no.
I know. It was so heartbreaking. I'm like, mate, I'm so sorry. But like, we're the worst parents.
He's got some, he's got a few hours to watch where he can see what went down.
Yeah.
There's so many things I still want to speak to you about. I'm just curious how did becoming a dad change you? Like, look at your life experiences, your relationship with your own dad and your brother, and then going to the army. Is it what you thought it would be? Has it changed you in ways that you didn't expect?
Yeah, I think everyone wonders what it would be like to be a parent. And what surprised me about it is it's a chance to live life again, but with someone else. Mm-hmm. So you get to show them the moon for the first time. You get to go to the beach for the first time. There's all these things that are so intriguing and good about our world, and you get to see them again through someone else's eyes.
Yeah.
And that's what I've loved about it. It makes your life a lot bigger. There's a lot more joy in your life. It's a really good thing.
Mm. Speaking of looking at the moon, you posted a picture of the NASA James Webb telescope and you wrote something like, it brought tears to my eyes. And I share that perspective that just sometimes it's all so overwhelming, like just life in general and our experiences, particularly nature and things we can't quite grasp, are just so overwhelming that you just don't really know what to do with yourself. But I guess for you, what is it that's overwhelming about space or existence or the moon and the stars?
I think there's so much out there we don't know, I think. And there's all these organizations and people that are on the boundaries of science. I think they're always finding out something new and different about the universe. And I don't think what we can detect or see as humans is even close to the full story. There's there's only so much we can sense. And then behind that, there's all these other aspects of the universe that we can't detect or interact with properly or understand, like dark matter and gravitational wave, all these things that kind of defy, I guess, common sense or intuition. And that's, I kind of like reading about it or learning about it because it makes me think, wow, there is really something special about what we're living in.
And there is no real answer, which is why I also find it so fascinating, is because I can probe and ponder and, like, you know, grab all these resources and try and fill my brain up. But at the end of the day, it doesn't change anything because we don't know. We're just trying to grasp onto things and make sense. And I think that's the whole point of this podcast. It's like finding out what people cling on to, what's their meaning, what conclusion have they come to. So I guess for you, like, have you ever been a spiritual person? Have you ever searched for greater meaning? Is that a question that you've asked yourself just through the nature of your work and your life?
I've gone kind of full circle on this. I think when I went overseas and served, I was like, well, there can't be any sort of higher power, because if they're allowing this to happen, then there can't be anything. And then as I've kind of had more of my own spare time and researched and more, I'm like, there's actually so much we don't understand that, you know, who knows what could be a part of our universe. So, yeah, I've definitely kept an open mind on it.
You said a word before, you said intuition. Is that something that you use in decision making? I suppose when you're trained in the army, that's probably not the best way to make decisions. It would be very, like, factual and looking at the concrete evidence in front of you to make decisions. Or is it intuition?
There's a bit of both. I think sometimes you've got to be alert to the fact that we have this confirmation bias that when we choose a particular path, we'll ignore evidence that presents that might say something contrary might be a better approach. But probably the biggest thing I learned is that there's been one occasion where I didn't listen to my instincts, which was when we were in that cornfield first battle. I'm like, oh, this just doesn't quite feel right. I think we're a bit exposed.
Wow.
I think there's something not happening. And I kind of didn't take action at that point. And it's a big regret because I felt something was wrong and I was right. And I had another friend actually that was in a huge ambush where Mark Donaldson won his VC. It was kind of a contact. And he said he had the same thing. He goes, we had this other option where we could have walked around this valley. It would have taken us, you know, a couple of days, but we kind of took this shorter path and he felt it wasn't right. And sure enough, they got into it an all day. So I think you've got to trust your instincts. If something doesn't feel right, like, listen to that.
Hi, it's me. A quick little intermission. The episode is drawing to a close, but I thought I'd give you a quick heads up that the end of this episode is a recent catch up between Mark and I. He's had so much going on in the few months between recording this episode and releasing it, so I thought we need to get him back on the show to talk all about the exciting things that he's been up to, which is what you'll hear now. Thanks so much for listening to the episode, and we'll see you next time.
Mark, welcome back to Life Chats.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thank you. Well, you've certainly had a bit going on in the last little while since we've spoken. Let's start with Mad Max Furiosa. That's a pretty epic thing to be a part of. Tell me about how that all came about.
Yeah, it was weird because we filmed it so long ago, and then it was like a 18-month, nearly two-year wait until it came out. So it was really bizarre watching some of the scenes. But the way it came about is I'd heard about it. I'd heard that they were going to film a prequel to Fury Road in Australia. And there's one film I always wanted to be involved in that wouldn't require a whole lot of acting for me. It would be something like Mad Max. So I applied for an audition through my agent. I got this audition. I spent ages kind of getting myself in the mindset of being someone from that dystopian kind of wasteland and what that would be like and what your mentality would be. And I did an audition and got a call back with the director. Many months later, it took ages for him to come back to me and end up spending an hour on a Skype call with the director.
Wow.
And his script writer, which shows you how much they invest in, you know, I wasn't a huge character, but they spent time making sure everyone knew exactly what we were doing and the context behind it. So it was such a fun thing to be involved in.
Is that something that you see yourself branching out into the future, a bit of a film career?
I don't know about acting. It's too hard. Like I talked to a lot of real actors that were on there and I've got a lot of respect for them. They actually work really hard. They endure so much rejection just for these roles that they get occasionally. So I'd love to do it if I could like backdoor it, kind of like I did with this one. But I'd probably be more on the writing side now.
You've just released your second book, Outrider, but this is your first book in the fiction space after your autobiography. How was the process of writing that? I imagine it's quite a different process. Putting your pen to paper for your life story is quite different to creating a story. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it took so much more horsepower. I think with nonfiction, you're trying to decide what parts of a story you're going to include and you're trying to build a good narrative arc and explain what's already happened. Whereas with fiction, it's really you're building a lot from the ground up, a new world, a new set of characters and a plot that has to kind of resonate with people and have a good amount of heart. I think that was the hardest bit. It feels like I've explained this to people. It's like you're interpreting two things at once. You're trying to imagine the world and then you're trying to interpret it on the page at the same time. So it's kind of two things happening at once. So it does take a lot of thinking, but I really enjoyed it. It was good fun. I've forgotten the pain of writing now. Now I'm just enjoying having it out. So I've started on a second one, but once I formalize something for that, I'll keep working on it.
Very exciting. And do you feel like has creative writing been something that you've always explored, or it could, because it's a very unique skill. I think if a lot of people sat down to write a book, like even just a story, a short story, they'd be quite overwhelmed with what that takes creatively. So I'm interested, is that something you've like done throughout your life and you got the opportunity to write this book, or was this like a new challenge for you?
We're all storytellers and they've shown it with like brain scans and people get told stories. It unlocks a really ancient part of how we used to learn and pass information on is telling stories sitting around a fire. So the power of that's never gone away. We still have it. And I think most people are storytellers, even if they don't fully realize it. Yeah, it was totally new to try and get into that space. I've always been a reader, so I always loved fiction. And I think that just gives you a feel, a bit of experience around what looks right on the page or what sounds right on the page.
Where did the specific idea come from? Did you have like a bit of a light bulb moment, or was this like, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to sit down and think of something?
It came during the winters when I was living up in the Dandenong Ranges and also during lockdown as well. I was like, imagine if this just kept heading towards, you know, maybe a collapse of society in that world. Like, what would happen? Would anyone take advantage of that? And then I thought, well, that's actually not a bad premise. Like, parts of Australia collapse, we're on our own, maybe a civil war unfolds. Like, what would you do if you had a family and you were trying to survive something like that?
The response has been incredible considering this is your first fiction novel. Has it kind of surprised you?
Yeah, it has a bit. We've gotten some really good PR from it. I think there's been some good articles and good reviews come out about it. So really you have to push that stuff hard because there's so much competition. Like, why would you go with a new author when you know you can get, you know, a Lee Tyler book or a David Baldacci book and it's going to be a great read. Harper as well, she does great novels. So you've really got to push hard to try and get yourself above the you know, the slush pile.
I was going to ask that. Something you just said is you've got to take a chance on a new author. It's like a big thing to do. What do you think your publisher saw in you? Have they told you?
I think, well, they're always after male action writers. They don't have tons of them, and they're actually looking for them at the moment. And some of the ones that, you know, there's like an old guard almost. They're always looking for new people coming up that are going to provide them a stable of well-read books. And for them, it's a business choice, right? They want someone if they think has longevity, it's going to be able to deliver a lot of material because for the publishers, that's how they, you know, that's how they earn their wage. And if you're an author and you can sell well through them, then, you know, everyone's a winner.
So what you're saying is we can expect a trilogy.
I've actually written three opening scenes for the next book, because I'm like, I don't quite know which one. I had three different ideas for opening scenes, and I'm like, I'm just going to canvas all three of them and see what people like, and then I'll go from there.
Now, I have to ask you the question that I ask every guest the way that we finish these episodes. You can answer in as many or as little words as you like, but that question is, Mark, what is the meaning of life?
Well, I think you've got to find the things that bring you the most joy. I think you've got to realize that we're not here for very long. So you've really got to, a lot of the stuff we worry about is probably not as relevant as we think it is. It might feel like a big deal, but I think what matters most is do the things that you really love, try and enjoy yourself and stick with the people that you love as much as you can.
Amazing. Thank you so much for the, not just the one, but the two chats that we've had. And please let people know where they can find your book. If they want to book you for speaking, just your socials, any way to contact you would be great.
Yeah, you can find the book is at all good bookstores. For me, if you want to find me, I'm on Instagram under mark.a.wales. Look me up and say hello.
Amazing. Thanks so much. We'll see you next
Thanks.
Time.
See ya.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Please let me know who you'd love to hear from next, or if you have a story to share, I'd love to get in touch with you. You can connect directly with me on Instagram at lifechatspodcast, one word. And every review and share really does help so much in the early days of building a podcast. So if you've enjoyed this conversation, please share it on social media, or you can snap a pic of where you might be listening and jump onto Apple Podcasts and give us a review. I really do appreciate the support more than you know. Have a beautiful morning, afternoon, or evening wherever you may be listening in the world. I'm Georgia May, and this is Life Chats.